Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
It's one of the marquee matchups in American politics, the Senate race in Massachusetts between incumbent Ed Markey and Congressman Joe Kennedy III. And now we've finally seen the first direct confrontation. The two Democrats met last night in a debate broadcast on Channel 2. WBUR reporter Fred Tice was there and joins us now in the studio. Hey there, Fred.
Hey, Cal.
Also with us is Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of the Horse Race podcast, which follows Massachusetts politics, policy, and elections. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for having me.
WBUR is co-sponsoring a Senate debate next month in Springfield and the final debate before the September 1st primary, so there will be more chances to see these two candidates go at it. But first, let's talk about last night. What are the big takeaways? Stephanie, let me start with you. Who won this thing?
I don't think it's easy to declare a clear winner. So Kennedy got into this race in September, and between then and now, it's been a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes maneuvering, some endorsements, maybe a subtweet. So we finally got to see them go head-to-head on the debate stage and kind of confront each other for the first time in this semi-awkward, you know, it's two members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation going head-to-head. So I think it was tough to say a clear winner, but they've got a few more cracks at debating between now and September.
How about you, Fred? A clear winner or a draw as well?
I would say definitely a draw between the two. Markey just, you know, pretty much did a good job of defending his record. He could refine that a bit, and Kennedy talked about how he would change the office, and so that was something that was frustrating me a little bit because I couldn't really figure out why Kennedy was in this race other than sheer ambition or maybe family dynamics, you know, just living up to the family tradition. And afterwards, we got to talk to him, and he was claiming, you know, that he could do things differently. And so finally, I happened to be the one who asked him, like, well, what would you do? And here's what some of what he said.
Look at the way that we've tried to run this campaign. We did 13 town halls last month alone. Two of them were in Spanish. The first time any candidate's done town halls in another language. I was in nearly 20 states last cycle campaigning for other colleagues and helping to flip the House of Representatives. I think the ability that comes with the Massachusetts Senate seat enables you to go around the country to build that bench, to help elect mayors and local school boards and state reps and state senators.
Okay, so what he's talking about there, Fred, seems to be the sort of energy and exuberance that he would bring to the office, sort of suggesting without directly saying it that maybe some of that is lacking with Markey. But I will note he didn't exactly say that when he was at the table with Ed Markey. One of the first questions he got was, why are you in this race? Why are you challenging someone who shares so many policy points? So that's what he told you. Let's listen to what he told everybody on TV.
This is not a swing state, and this is not a swing seat. There is a special opportunity and obligation that comes with it. Because voting the right way and filing the right bill, Mitch McConnell doesn't care. This is about making sure that, one, you are a constant presence in Massachusetts, making sure that the people across our state know that you're fighting for them and know what to care about. That you have to ensure that you're bringing everything you possibly can to restore power to a Democratic Party so that we can actually advance the causes we care about and protect the people we care about.
So what did you make of that response there, Stephanie? It seems to me that he gave a more direct answer to Fred after the debate and maybe missed a chance during the debate itself to really explain why he's in this thing.
Well, part of the reason this was so interesting to me is that throughout his political career, the kind of knock on Ed Markey has been that he's not in Massachusetts enough. He spends too much time in Washington, D.C., in Maryland. And so it was interesting to me to hear, instead of saying, and what Kennedy's been saying a lot, is that he shows up in Massachusetts more than Markey, or he says he shows up and you have to kind of read between the lines to see that that's more than Markey. But to answer that question by saying he'd be going to 20 other states to campaign, it seemed kind of interesting when I expected the knock to be that Markey wasn't here enough, but he wants to leave the state too, I guess.
Of course, the flip side of this question is, for Markey, why should we send you back for yet another term? As we all know, he's been in Congress longer than Joe Kennedy has even been alive. Some people think a fresh face is exactly what the party needs. So here's how he responded to that line of questioning.
This whole debate should be about the future. And that's what I fight for every single day. On the big issues of today, the challenges of today, I've not only been leading, but I've been delivering with legislation which passes, which protects the people of Massachusetts and the whole country.
So how about that response there, Fred? I mean, Ed Markey is saying, well, I may not be the future at my age, but I've always been fighting for the future, and you should send me back to keep doing it.
One of the interesting things was that very early on, he signed on to the Green New Deal, in fact, was the lead sponsor, made sure that he was associated with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, someone whose name came up over and over again in his on his lips last night. And, you know, he's really trying to make this argument. He perhaps not so persuasively, because he was saying a lot to us, I am the new generation. He said that several times. And, you know, it's kind of a big step to say that he's the next generation.
In his 70s.
Right, yeah.
But he certainly aligned himself with the next generation, right? I mean, Stephanie, that seemed to me to be one of the smartest political moves that he made even before he knew that he definitely had a primary challenger. He seemed to anticipate. Maybe he looked at what happened to Michael Capuano in the Ayanna Pressley race, and he cozied up right away to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and got with her on that Green New Deal.
Ed Markey's big problem, I mean, even since he got in the Senate 6 years ago, is that he has been kind of the behind-the-scenes legislator. He's been signing on to the right bills. He's been doing the work, but he hasn't really been showing his constituents exactly what he's been doing and kind of being an out-front national figure. And so I think to protect that weak spot, he did cozy up to AOC because she is that national firebrand figure who's out there on issues, which is something that he's not been doing. And so what Kennedy's saying is, instead of cozying up to AOC and doing it this way, I'll just try to be out there and be the national figure for you myself.
So he pointed to that, Green New Deal as one of his, you know, sort of contemporary legislative accomplishments, even though it hasn't actually gone anywhere in Congress yet. He says it's reshaped the conversation, which is an accomplishment on its own. But he also was looking back to his long track record in Washington. And I want to play a key exchange from last night's debate where the two candidates kind of go back and forth with Kennedy trying to knock Markey for maybe being part of the gridlock in Washington and Markey firing right back at him. Let's listen to that.
Congress has not, the federal government has not, passed meaningful gun violence legislation in decades. When it comes to the environment, we have not. Senator Markey's been a leader on this, and he has been. But the last transformative law that was signed into the bill that was signed into law to transform the way the federal government protects the environment was signed by Richard Nixon with the Clean Air Act.
Yes, can I interrupt? Honestly, that's just not accurate. The last meaningful gun safety legislation passed in the last week of December of 2019. When my bill was actually signed by Donald Trump to begin research at the CDC that had been blocked for 25 years by the NRA. And I might say, the last environmental law, the big one, well, that was my law as well. It was the 2007 law that doubled the fuel economy standards of the vehicles which we drive. It's the single largest reduction of greenhouse gases of any law ever passed in any country in the world. So fossil fuel industry, I beat them. The gun lobby, I beat them just in December. Beat them. The law is on the books.
So this is a key exchange right here, Fred Tice. And there's sort of two parts to it. There's the gun part and the environmental part. I want to take the gun part first. This sort of spat kind of hinges on the meaningful word, right? Where, you know, Kennedy says we haven't had meaningful legislation in a long time. Just to fill in the details, that bill that Markey's talking about, which just passed in December, allocates $25 million for research on gun violence, which is going to be split between the CDC and the National Institutes of Health. And as he said, funding had been blocked, or effectively blocked, since the Dickey Amendment in 1996. So this is a Democratic victory when you've got Republicans controlling the Senate and the White House. But is it meaningful, Fred, for people who want something more like, say, an assault weapons ban?
Well, Kennedy would argue no. You know, in fact, I think he started out this whole exchange talking about how it's been 2 years since the shootings in Parkland, Florida, on Valentine's Day, nothing's really big has passed through. And it gets back to this argument between the two of them that in Mitch McConnell's Senate, nothing meaningful is going to come through, and so it's not even worth fighting the battles there. That is Kennedy's argument. And Markey pushing back, Markey, the guy who's pushed through all this legislation in all these years in the House, then the Senate, saying, no, actually, even in this environment, you can get something done, right?
So that was the gun part of it. On the environment part, I do want to come in with a little fact check here on Ed Markey's fuel economy claim. So he was talking there about the 2007 Energy Independence and Security Act, which did increase fuel economy standards, but by 40%, didn't double them, as he claimed. And it's worth noting that the standard it set for average fuel economy was 35 miles a gallon by 2020. Well, here we are. It's 2020. And if you look at the latest figures from the EPA, they suggest we're not really at 35 miles per gallon yet, even for model year cars coming out this year. So, Stephanie Murray, I mean, is it worse that Ed Markey sort of exaggerated the economy accomplishments there? Or is it worse that Kennedy wasn't really ready with a response?
Look, I mean, Ed Markey is going to talk about his record, and I mean, this is part of it. But the thing that was kind of frustrating to me as I was listening to this debate was that Kennedy and Markey kind of have the same problem right now, which is that they don't have an answer on how they are going to act in the Senate under President Donald Trump if he's reelected, and under Mitch McConnell if he stays in a Republican-controlled Senate. And both of those realities are pretty plausible. So, I mean, we can debate back and forth all of these idealized things, but when it comes to the kind of bread and butter legislating and reaching across the aisle or not, I mean, I didn't really get an answer on how to, once they're in, how they'll do the job if things are the same as they are now.
So there weren't very many policy differences between them, but one area of disagreement was on what we've come to know in Massachusetts colloquially as the People's Pledge, which is about campaign finance. Congressman Kennedy has challenged Markey to support this pledge, which is similar to one that he adopted in 2013 and 14, but he's not behind it now. Here's that exchange.
I've introduced a progressive People's Pledge for 2020. So that we deal with the era of Donald Trump. Yeah, we should have a pledge that keeps out dark money, that keeps out negative voices. But we should welcome positive voices. We should welcome disclosed contributions so that environmentalists, women's groups, labor groups, LGBTQ groups can speak. We need to have a new modern people's pledge, not an old one.
It was good enough for Senator Markey back in 2013. It was good enough in 2014 when he championed it. It's the same pledge now. You start making people, adding in voices that we like, who gets to decide which voices those are? Dark money is dark money.
So Fred Tice, can you help us referee that one? I mean, is Ed Markey right that, look, times have changed, we're in the Trump era, the rules should be different, or is he a hypocrite, which is basically what Kennedy alleged?
Yeah, I'm not going to take a side here, but I'll have to say that Markey is clearly trying to get all the groups that support him to be able to allow to have ads, you know, nice supportive ads about all the things that he's done in all these different fields. I mean, he's clearly does have the support of a lot of environmentalists, for example, and he would just love for them to come in and do some outside group advertising.
Yeah, implied but not said explicitly there, Stephanie, was that these outside groups that are saying positive things, as Markey said, they're largely groups that have endorsed his reelection, right? I mean, it makes sense. It's politically advantageous for him to maybe, you know, waver from the People's Pledge a little bit here, right?
Well, it's politically advantageous for Kennedy, too. I mean, in the last quarter of the year, he outraised Markey by $1 million. So he has a lot more money in his war chest. He's shown that he has an ability to raise more money than Markey does. So kind of cutting Markey off at the knees on these outside expenditures would work for him. But the thing that was interesting to me was Markey got asked about how this positive People's Pledge would work, and it seems like he wasn't really quite sure. And he suggested that the media would be the ones to decide who would which ads were positive or negative. And I don't know about you, Fred, but I'm not sure who that meant or what. It was confused
that to me. How did you, I don't know about you, Fred. I took that to mean that he meant that the TV stations or the radio stations would have to decide whether they're willing to air it or not based on some standard of fairness or darkness. Is that how you read it, or did you think it was?
Yeah, it wasn't quite clear. And Kennedy had a really good comeback to that. Right? He said, well, Fox News might choose this way. WGBH might decide something else. You know, this is nonsense. This is not, you know, a standard that can possibly be applied, right?
All right. Well, it was certainly a first round that was entertaining, and there are more to come. A reminder, WBUR is sponsoring two more Senate debates. There's one next month in Springfield, and we'll also have the final debate before voters go to the polls on September 1st. WBUR reporter Fred Tice, thank you so much for attending the debate last night and joining us now.
Thanks, Cal.
Our thanks also to Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of the Horse Race podcast, which follows Massachusetts politics, policy, and elections. Thanks, Stephanie.
My pleasure.
So many of us have been there. You battle your way through airport traffic, dump your water, remove your shoes, and you step through the body scanner. At long last, you make it to your seat on the plane, and then you must decide to recline or not to recline. This seemingly small question now feels urgent and polarizing ever since a viral video showed a man on an American Airlines flight punching the back of a seat that a woman in front of him had tilted back. So today we're talking about airplane etiquette. Do you recline when flying, or are you anti-reclining? Are you one of the 2 million plus people who've seen this video of that flight? who's really in the wrong here? Give us a ring. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us in Studio 3 to help sort through all these important airline etiquette questions is Brenda Wynn. She's a Boston-based travel writer who runs Wandering Boston Eater, a travel and food Instagram account. Brenda, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us on the line from the Emily Post Institute in Vermont is Daniel Post Senning. He's the great-great-grandson of Emily Post and a co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette, 19th edition. Daniel, welcome to you as well.
It's good to be with you.
All right, Brenda, can I just start with you for some of the basics here? In case there's someone out there who hasn't seen this video for themselves, I'd like to just describe what's in it. I sort of gave a little synopsis at the top, but this is the last row and the second to last row on the plane. What happens, Brenda?
Yeah, so what happens is during the meal session, the man in the last row, he asks the woman who's sitting in front of him to not recline her seat because of the meal tray. So she obliges. She, you know, moves her seat up front. But once the meal is over, then she reclines her seat again. And afterwards, he begins to punch her seat.
And she films the whole thing?
And she filmed the whole thing because she didn't feel comfortable talking to him about how he was punching her seat. She did try to flag the flight attendant. It looks like the flight attendant did not want to participate, or so the story goes. And ultimately, she received a notice saying that she was the one that was a disturbance on the flight.
Okay.
So it's quite fascinating.
It is. And of course, the video is just a snapshot. We don't know all the context of what happens before and after. We haven't heard from the man who's shown in the video, but we have heard from the woman. Her name is Wendy Williams, and she spoke with CNN yesterday. She said she actually tried to engage with this man before she started filming, but she says it didn't go well.
There was something wrong with the whole thing, you know, that he could verbalize that he wanted me to not recline while he ate, but then when I reclined again, that he, you know, just immediately started throwing punches. So, yeah, it wasn't something I felt was negotiable at that point.
All right, Daniel, let me come to you then. I mean, you've seen this video as well. I mean, what is the proper etiquette here? Where did this interaction go off the rails?
Well, in some ways, I want to go all the way back to the airline that puts people in this incredibly awkward and difficult situation where there's an option that's presented, this reclining seat, and yet we're confined in spaces where to exercise that option is really to impose on someone else. Now, having said that, I don't ever want to suggest that it's okay to punch the back of the seat in front of you. So, I mean, I'm going to draw a really hard line and say that anytime you're physically intimidating someone else, you're in the wrong. There's no excuse for that kind of behavior. And I would have really liked to have seen the person with the authority in the situation, in this case it would be the flight attendant, deal with this situation much more promptly. And if they didn't, I would want any passenger to feel comfortable getting up, leaving their seat, and insisting that the person with the authority deals with the situation the way they should.
All right, we're talking about airplane etiquette after that viral video that's been making the rounds on the internet for a couple of weeks. We're chatting with Daniel Post Senning, who is the co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette, 19th edition, and Boston-based travel writer Brenda Wynn. And you, if you'd like to chime in, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lauren is in Somerville. Go ahead, Lauren. What do you think?
Hi, I find this whole incident very interesting because I am over 6 feet tall and I'm originally from California, so I do a lot of coast to coast travel. So I'm very familiar with how frustrated people are to not fit in airline seats. But I also feel that people should be allowed to lean their seat back. If it's an inconvenience, I've asked people before or frankly apologize because if I cross my legs and uncross them, I'm going to bump their seat. But I really hope that this woman in particular sues the man behind her because he basically assaulted her. And if he had punched her on the street and there was a bag between them or like another person, he would be in serious trouble for that. And this is just crazy to me.
Well, thanks for the ring, Lauren. And the woman, Wendy Williams, has in fact been threatening to sue, although she's thinking about suing the airline, American Airlines, for defamation because of that angry notice that Brenda mentioned earlier. Let's take one more while we're at it. Evan is in Brighton. Go ahead, Evan.
Hey there. Yeah, I would chime in. I definitely don't condone his behavior, but I will say as a taller flyer, I don't think a lot of people realize that height is a privilege in some ways, and the world just generally isn't designed for taller people. In some cases when I fly, I actually get bruises on my legs from people reclining. I think it would be awesome if airlines just disabled that functionality entirely.
All right, Evan, thank you for the ring. So how about that, Brenda? I mean, so if folks can't see us, you and I are on the smaller in stature side. We don't have this problem, but we just heard from Evan and Lauren, who are both tall folks, saying, you know, look, maybe it's an advantage in other aspects of life, but on a plane, it's a real pain in the neck. We're already cramped in there, and folks who were thinking about reclining in front of us ought to be more considerate. Are they right?
You know, it's really curious because I think about how each airline is so different in terms of what their seats are like and what the width of their seats are, the comfortability of seats. And it's become a tool of marketing now at this point where it's, hey, we have more leg room. So for me, going back to what Evan was saying about how height is a privilege, I think overall the question becomes, when did being comfortable become a privilege? Because, you know, if you're in an economy seat, you're in this very small seat, airlines are trying to cram in as many seats as possible to turn over a profit, and they're trying to really increase the price or give you a separate ticket if you're able to afford getting that extra legroom or going up to business class. So overall, when did it become a privilege to be comfortable, and why isn't it more standardized so that way people know what exactly to expect as they're going in? They know exactly, no matter what airline you're going on, that you understand what the seats are going to be like, whether it can recline or not recline. So that way you're able to start developing certain behaviors as to whether or not you can react or not react to a scenario.
Well, just to put some numbers on the comfort that you're describing there, Brenda. So the website Trip Savvy, which tracks these things, says that the average seat pitch in coach on a U.S. airline is between 30 and 33 inches. And Time Magazine reports that some are even as small as 28 inches. And this is all down from the average in the early 2000s of 34 inches. So it's not your imagination, folks. The seats are getting smaller. And meanwhile, sort of this flyers advocacy group called Flyers Rights in 2018 sued the FAA, saying you should step in and regulate the size of seats and legroom. And the FAA declined. Daniel, I wonder, is that something that they need to do right now? If people can't just sort of, you know, conduct themselves with more courtesy with one another, do we need a regulator to step in here and do something about it?
Well, I'm the eternal optimist. I think that our good natures will prevail. I love Brenda's idea of standardizing it, and I like the language of so people know what to expect going in. Social expectations work for us because they give us some sense of both what we can expect from others and how we can prepare ourselves. And I love to recommend to people that they prepare themselves for these oftentimes awkward and difficult situations. You can affect the greatest change by controlling the things that you have the most control over, and that's your own behaviors and your own reactions and responses. So prepare yourself with a smile on your face, a little patience in your heart, some goodwill to your fellow travelers who may or may not be in as positive a state of mind. And I think that we're going to collectively take responsibility for these shared spaces in the best possible ways.
So no surprise, folks feel very strongly on both sides of this issue. Let's hear from a few more people. You're lining up on the phones. David is in Pawtucket. Go ahead, David.
Hello. Yeah, so the responsibility is on the airline here, not the riders. You shouldn't have to choose whether you can recline your seat or not. It's the greed of airlines that makes you uncomfortable. If there's no space, you know, you can't be comfortable, like the young lady was saying. And my other point was you should be able to recline, because if you've ever sat in a plane and sat straight up the whole time, it's so uncomfortable. But thank you very much.
David, thanks for the ring. Arlene is in Salem. Let's take one more. Go ahead, Arlene.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I think that, you know, it goes both ways. The gentleman who was hitting his seat at the lady in front of her, perhaps he should have said, you know, I'm a little cramped back here. Would you consider, because you don't have to push it all the way back, you can recline it a little bit. But also the person that was sitting next to the gentleman that could have said, hey, you know, that's not, you know, the right thing to do. Sometimes you have to step in out of your comfort zone and bring somebody into reality and say, you know, that's not good behavior. Like, what are you doing? You know,
Arlene, thank you. If you'd like to chime in again, the number to join the conversation is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel, post-sending, let me pick up Arlene's point there. I mean, she's saying that there was really sort of like a collective failure of common courtesy by a lot of parties on this flight. I mean, not just the two that we see in the video, but perhaps also the flight attendants and people sitting around them. What do you think?
I think there is a lot of power in social accountability to people around us. And
sometimes just a glance can be enough to bring someone's attention to something that they're doing that they might not even be aware of, something less egregious than this particular example. And that kind of social accountability can be really powerful. I also like to tell people if they don't want to confront something like that, there are other alternatives and options. There are people who have the authority to deal with these situations in public spaces, and it is okay to turn to those people as things escalate.
I do want to mention what the airline itself has said. So this is the statement from American Airlines, and they say simply, quote, "We are aware of a customer dispute that transpired on American Eagle Flight 4392. The safety and comfort of our customers and team members is our top priority, and our team is looking into the issue." So not a whole lot of weighing in one side or the other there. We did hear, though, recently from another airline executive. So Ed Bastian is the chief executive of Delta Airlines. He was asked about this in an interview on CNBC last week, and here's his position on ReclineGate.
I think customers have the right to recline. We've been testing reduced recline and seeing response on that. We actually have a fair amount of our fleet on a reduced recline. But I think the proper thing to do is if you're gonna recline into somebody that you ask if it's okay first, and then you do it. I think if someone knows there's a tall person behind them and they want to recline their seat, I think the polite thing would be to make certain it was okay.
So, Brenda Wynn, we hear Delta CEO Ed Bastian making a few points there. He's saying that, you know, it'd be polite to just ask, you know, think about the size of the person behind you. But he basically says, look, you have the right to recline. And by the way, they don't go back all that far. This is something else we've seen, too, right? I mean, it's not like these are lay flat seats in coach.
Right. I think they only go back like 2 inches, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, exactly. So I actually want to go back to Daniel's point about power and social accountability, too. And just to Bastian's point as well about how it's okay to ask. So I guess this comes up to the point of, you know, if somebody is in the backseat, they're in the last row, they're taller than, you know, the seat allows them to be essentially, maybe it is okay to ask. And I understand that, you know, when you're choosing your flights and you're going through the ticket process of checking in, you have the option of choosing your seat then at that point, too. And some seats do, again, cost more than others. But then it's okay to ask and say, hey, this seat is actually a lot more uncomfortable than I'm, you know, able to, you know, manage right now. Is somebody willing to switch seats with me? And I've actually been somebody who has switched seats because, again, to your point, I'm 5 feet tall, so I have the height privilege when it comes to a plane.
Right, in that particular arena. I wonder, Brenda, what did you make of the gender dynamic that we saw in this video? You know, the term man-spreading has been injected into the popular lexicon here. This is not, it wasn't sort of spreading out side to side as we usually think of it, but this was a case perhaps of a man sitting in the back row who seemed to think he was entitled to more space than her reclined seat in front of him was allowing.
And, you know, I think gender aside, it's very uncomfortable to be in a back row in the first place, too, because of, again, the lack of reclining ability on the seat. So I think it's just important that, you know, not to confuse and start deterring, you know, the other source of issues and try to really focus on what is actually the root cause of this issue right now. And I guess for me and my perspective, the root cause would be ultimately the airline doesn't give enough space.
All right, let's try to squeeze in a few more calls. Lucia is in Reading. Lucia, what do you think about the whole situation? Go ahead,
Hi,
Lucia.
Hi, it's Insia.
Lucia, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No problem. I was just saying that, you know, just having the reclining seats is a great option. And unfortunately, just because we cannot be courteous or tolerating of this situation, I feel like this will go in this direction where half the seats will be reclinable and half will not be, and you will get a surcharge for the reclining seats. And they'll probably be selling the non-reclining seats a little cheaper. And I feel like we all lose with this situation, you know, where for the comfort that we all have right now, we'll have to then pay a surcharge for.
Lucia, thanks for the ring. How about Janet? Go ahead, Janet. We've just lost you. I'm sorry. Let's try Pam is in Groton. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, this is Pam. I just wanted to say that I'm a frequent flyer. I do believe that this is not an issue of reclining seats. This is an issue where the airlines need to make the seats larger, not only so that they are able to recline, but also in the width as well. It's an issue on almost every flight that I go on that, you know, this becomes a problem. And I do believe that that gentleman who, well, he's no gentleman, that banged that woman should be in jail.
Okay, strong take there from Pam. Although consistent, Brenda, you did sort of an informal poll on this on your Instagram account, right? And the public was very divided. What did you find there?
You know, it's quite fascinating. So just a couple hours ago, I posted a poll on my Instagram story just to see, you know, are you pro reclining seat? Are you no reclining seat? And right now, that's really, you know, just tapering between that 50-50 line. It just keeps on going over the 50-50 line, and it's just a world divided right now. But then I asked the second question afterwards, where I said, are you okay with the person sitting in front of you reclining the seat? And to that, it seems like it's more than 60% of the people who have pulled into my story so far have stated, yeah, they're okay with that, too. So it does seem like right now the majority is okay with reclining seats if it's in front of you. But whether or not someone chooses to personally recline the seat is kind of a world divided.
Interesting. Unscientific poll, I'll note,
but
an interesting data point.
Just a fun social experiment,
exactly.
Essentially.
Let's try to squeeze in one more call while we can. Stephen is in Newbury. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hi. What I do with a person that's reclining too much is simply turn on my overhead light and move it so it's as forward as much as possible. And also with the airflow, I turn it on and move it as forward as much as possible so that the person in front of me enjoys more light and more airflow. That usually causes a reversal of inclination.
Okay, Stephen, thank you for the ring. All right, Daniel Post sending. You know I'm coming to you on this one. How does that register on the etiquette meter? It's not punching, but it sounds like maybe a subtle message there that's not so polite.
Oh, boy, fighting fire with fire. Something came up earlier where I believe it was the CEO was talking about it's your right to recline. Essentially, it's within what's allowed to you, so you can do it if you want. And I want to remind everyone that with rights come responsibilities, that you also have the right to say just about anything you want. And that doesn't mean it's always okay to do that. And I think Lucia reminded us that if we don't handle our rights well, if we don't handle them with responsibility, sometimes they get removed or we don't have as much access to them. So rather than take that low road, I'm going to put on my best etiquette advice hat and say, keep the high ground. It's the place you want to be. You never know when you're going to end up with 2 million views on the internet.
All right. So no, you know, warfare with the lights and the blowers. Let's just try to be civil to one another. Daniel Post-Senning is the great-great-grandson of Emily Post and a co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette 19th Edition. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us was Brenda Wynn. She's a Boston-based travel writer who runs Wandering Boston Eater, a travel and food Instagram account. Brenda, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
We're going to spend the rest of our time today talking about, well, time. Joining me here in Studio 3 to help us do that is Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His new book is called Until the End of Time: Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. He's in town for a talk tonight at Harvard University in Science Center Hall B at 7 p.m. You can find more about that on our website, radioboston.org. Brian Green, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, if you have a question for Brian Green, we'd love to hear from you. Any thoughts or questions about science or science education? You can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And as always, you can tweet at us at Radio Boston. Brian, I got to say, sometimes these types of sciencey books that contemplate the end of the universe can leave me feeling a bit depressed, like nothing matters, you know, it's all going to end anyway. So how do you go about sort of finding meaning in a universe that you predict will someday not only end for each one of us individually, but perhaps all of life will be gone?
Well, that really is the theme of the entire book. and it's a great question and one that motivated a lot of thinking by many people over a great period of time. My own take on it is that when you recognize that not only are we individuals going to die, and not only is everything that we know about in the world ultimately going to dissolve into particles that waft through the void, it focuses your attention on the moment. It focuses on the things that are happening now, and it makes you recognize that you need to manufacture your own meaning. You have to find your own purpose, and looking out to the cosmos to find the ultimate answer is the wrong direction. Ultimately, it's a spiritual, personal journey that takes place within the rigorous unfolding of the cosmos.
So before you waft into the void, get to living, right?
That's exactly right.
Your book also delves into some pretty deep science. You explain entropy, for example. And overall, though, I'd say it's actually pretty accessible, though, to non-science majors. And I'm curious how you think about that balance. I mean, you want to be true to the science. You don't want to oversimplify things, but you also want to bring in a mainstream audience. How do you walk that line?
Well, that is the art of writing these kinds of books, and different authors draw the line in different places. My own view is I want to really give a true sense of the underlying science, not turn it into a cartoon. But at the same time, it has to be about wonder. It has to be about excitement at understanding how the universe works. So there's no math, of course, until the end of time. But I translate the real rigorous ideas of the mathematics into accessible language. So you get a sense of how the universe began. You get a sense of where life came from. You get a sense of the nature of consciousness. And you pivot with me toward a look into the very far future. And you gain an understanding of where we are all headed.
We're talking about Science Time with Professor Brian Greene. And for that matter, if you want to ask him about the meaning of life, you can do that too. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to join our conversation. On the subject of time, Brian, you know, you have this sort of contradiction in a way in your book that I find interesting. You say on the one hand, it's something that we can measure very precisely down to the second or millisecond or nanosecond. And it's also something we don't fully understand. Can you explain that tension?
Yeah, that's weird, right? I mean, usually you think that if you can measure something with fantastic precision, you must understand what it is that you are measuring. But for a very long time, we've known that we don't have a full understanding of what time actually is. We don't understand if it's a fundamental quality of existence. We don't understand if it's something that the human mind imposes on the external world to organize our perceptions. Or is it somehow fundamentally stitched into the tapestry of reality? And these are questions that we struggle with today. String theory, in my own field of research, seems to suggest that time may be emergent in the sense that there may be realms of reality where the very nature of time, the very notion of time, may not apply.
You mentioned the word spiritual earlier.
Yeah.
That piqued my interest. Explain that a little bit more. I mean, where does spirituality fit into science?
Good.
Those two sometimes seem to be at odds with each
other. Yeah, they often are described as at odds with each other. But when you recognize that science is about giving us an understanding of the external world, we want to understand the particles that make up matter. We want to understand how matter comes together and yields cells and living beings and planets and stars. We want to understand the expansion of space. All of that is objective qualities of the external world that science is well equipped to give us insight into. But there's another part of reality, which is the inner part of reality, the experience of reality, and the journey to understand our own inner world, our own conscious experience, how we take in the external world. For many, that is a spiritual journey, because you are understanding aspects of the world that are not accessible to an objective external observation. Rather, they are deeply personal. And for many, that journey involves things that science often stays away from: religious undertakings, spiritual quests, and these kinds of parts of reality I consider equally vital to a full understanding of what it means to be human.
All right. Let's take a call while we're at it. You've opened up a lot of interesting subjects here, so I want to give folks a chance to weigh in. Jane is in Quincy. Go ahead, Jane.
Hello, Brian Greene. I've read or heard about you for years. I'm 86. I teach meditation and Qigong, and I'm also very interested in Wu Wei and also consciousness beyond life. And so your book, I guess it's new, would be an interesting one to read. And I'm also interested in that 30-year-old photograph that they took from outer space, the Voyager 1, of the little blue dot, or the pale blue dot, way back 30 years ago. And is there anything about those particular things of the cosmos and the microcosm in your book?
Well, yeah, I wish perhaps you can come to my talk tonight. You mentioned that it's at Harvard at the Science Center at 7 p.m., because I will begin that discussion tonight with the pale blue dot photograph, where we see little planet Earth embedded in the grander expanse of space with Saturn in the foreground. Because to me, and perhaps to you as well, that image provides perspective like none other on how we fit into the grand expanse of space. And the point of my book and the point of the discussion tonight is to give a sense of how we fit into the expanse of time. So in many ways, my book and the discussion tonight is an extension of that pale blue dot photograph.
So Jane and Quincy, great question there. You've sort of set the table for tonight's event. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian, I was hoping that you could read an excerpt of your book for us while we have you, because there's some sort of abstract concepts in there, but you've also got some fun personal anecdotes, and this is one that caught my eye. So this is on page 310, and you're describing preparing for a safari in South Africa. It's supposed to be a walking safari, but you're a little bit nervous. You're thinking about backing out, and your guide is warning people not to do anything dumb, like try to outrun a lion. And then this happens. Would you pick it up from there?
Absolutely. Just then, I glanced down at the sleeve of my loose-fitting shirt, identifying precisely what was clinging to my cuff was of little concern. To me, it was a tarantula, and it was making its way upward. I freaked. My arm flew back and forth, knocking glasses off the breakfast table. I jumped from my chair, and plates that had survived my initial flailing were now flailing too. In the mayhem, the tarantula, or whatever creepy thing it actually was, detached. By the time I regained composure, the little nickel-sized creature was on the ground, slowly crawling away. "Ah," the guide said, smiling when all had settled down, "the universe has spoken for our physicist friend. You travel in the Jeep." And I did. The universe had not spoken for me. The attack was random and its timing blind chance. Were I a disinterested party, I would offer my standard riposte noted earlier that in the absence of such an event, there would be no surprise that such a coincidence had not happened. But the truth is, for a brief moment, the embarrassing episode felt significant.
All right, I love this moment, Brian, because it's, first of all, it's a sort of a funny scene that you paint. But I think it's a moment that a lot of people can relate to as they read, right? I mean, you can even if you accept the scientific premise that this was random chance, as you put it, there was nothing, the universe was not speaking to you, it does feel significant. In fact, as you had confessed, you actually were thinking about backing out and maybe were more comfortable in the Jeep, and this event got you to where you maybe should have been all along. I mean, how do you wrestle with those things?
Well, I look at the human species as a pattern-seeking species. The reason that we have survived is we're really good at looking out at the world and finding patterns that allow us to figure out what's going to happen next, right? But we're so good at it and so primed to seek out pattern that sometimes we find patterns that really are not significant at all. And this is an example of that, right? It felt to me that the universe was shaking its finger at me and saying, Brian, do not go out on that safari on foot. Something bad is going to happen. And I took it in that way and I didn't go on foot. But of course, that's nonsense, right? That's not how the world works. The universe doesn't care about what I'm going to do or if I survive or not. And so as we go about the world, we have to use our judgment to figure out what patterns are actually giving us insight into the nature of reality and what patterns just happen to happen because random events occur in the world.
We're chatting with physicist Brian Greene about his new book, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. If you'd like to jump in, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian, I do want to pivot a little bit to another subject that I know is important to you, which is science education.
Yeah.
And perhaps you'll talk about that more tonight. But, you know, you co-founded the World Science Festival in 2008. So why did you do that, first of all? And why do you think it is so important for science to remain at the center of our education today?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the future and every opportunity we have and every challenge we face has science at its core. I mean, the obvious ones that we all know about are climate change, but the opportunities with space travel, genetic engineering, personalized medicine. I mean, it's an amazing place that we're sitting at right now. And you have to have leaders that have an understanding of science in order that the decisions made are sensible and they're ultimately democratic. And so we have to have the next generation excited about science. And the thing is, if you look at kids, they're all excited about science when they're really little. They smash things together. They pull things apart. They're little scientists trying to figure out the nature of the world around them.
So what happens then?
What happens is, well, look, there are some really good teachers, so don't take a generalization the wrong way. But in general, our educational system does not inspire kids to keep up that deep interest in science. We're so focused on assessment, on testing kids. I mean, my kids are in middle school and high school now, and all they do is learn their science in order to take Tuesday's quiz or Wednesday's exam. And after it's over, they forget about the material because they've accomplished what they needed to do. That is tragic. That is utterly tragic. We need to present the ideas of science in a way that it touches kids and adults in a deep way and inspires them to want to understand their world. And that is something that, for instance, I try to do in my books. It's why we started this World Science Festival that you mentioned. And it's my hope that the educational system will ultimately align itself with that kind of goal.
Well, you've given me more questions to think about, but I do want to give the callers a chance to weigh in too. John is in Bridgewater. Go ahead, John. John, are you there? Go ahead.
Okay.
John, what's your question?
Hello? Well, human beings tend to conceptualize time in terms of their own life expectancy. So we think 80 years is a long time, whereas in the scheme of the universe, it's totally insignificant. So we have this concept that's all sort of selfishly oriented to our own life expectancy.
Yeah, it's a good point, John. Thanks for the ring. For my three-year-old, you know, an hour is a long time, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's all relative.
Absolutely. Now, look, you know, the human lifespan is the most vital time scale that we experience as individuals, but the caller's absolutely right. When we think about time in the universe, that is a blink of an eye. And in my book and in tonight's discussion, I will take the audience from now 10 to the 100 years into the future. I mean, that is an enormous time scale. And yet, the beauty of science is using mathematics, we can make some fairly confident predictions of what's going to transpire between now and 1 billion years from now and 100 billion years from now and a Google of years from now, which is what 10 to the 100 is. So you're absolutely right. On those scales, the human lifespan is less than a blink of an eye.
Tumbling, when you put it that way.
It is.
In just the moments we have left, Brian, I mean, what are you working on next? I mean, what excites you that might also be infectious for others?
Well, actually, it's the conversation we're talking about. My research right now is focused on time, trying to figure out where it comes from and if we can use our cutting-edge theories, our unified theories like string theory, to gain a deeper understanding of where time itself comes from.
That's Brian Green. He's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His new book is called Until the End of Time: Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. He's in town for a talk tonight at Harvard. As he said, he'll be in Science Center Hall B at 7 p.m. And you can find more details about that at radioboston.org. Brian, thanks so much for taking time to stop in with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks also for your participation today. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.